Hello, welcome to Regenerative Rising's podcast series, Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. My name is Elizabeth Candelario. I am your guest host today, and I am absolutely delighted to be joined by my dear friend, professional mentor, and colleague, Paul Dolan. I want to tell you a little bit about Paul's background. He's a fourth generation wine grape grower and winemaker. In 1881, his great-grandfather founded Italian-Swiss Colony, an agricultural enterprise that was focused primarily on growing wine grapes. They sold to markets across the United States, but also Europe, South America, and Asia. Paul served as winemaker and ultimately president of Fetzer Brands. While at Fetzer, he launched Bonterra, the first nationally distributed wine made with 100% organic grapes. During his tenure, Paul proved through his example that wineries and grape growers can preserve and enhance their environment, strengthen their communities, and enrich the lives of their employees without sacrificing the bottom line. Almost 20 years ago, Paul published a book called True to Our Roots, Fermenting a Business Revolution. When he wrote that book, it caused Paul Hawken to comment, "If only there were a room full of Paul Dolans in America, we would be a profoundly different and better country in 20 years. So here we are 20 years later, and maybe this podcast will help encourage more Paul Dolans. Paul also served as the chair of the California Wine Institute. Through his leadership there, he launched the Code of Sustainable Wine Growing Practices that still serves as the guidebook for vintners and winemakers interested in following sustainable practices, both in their vineyards and also in their businesses. Paul and his family have the most beautiful biodynamic ranch in Mendocino County in Northern California. He is also CEO of Truett Hurst, where we are filming today, a certified organic and biodynamic vineyard. And it's located in the heart of Dry Creek Valley in Sonoma County, about 55 miles north of the Golden Gate Bridge. So Paul, it's really nice to have you here today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm really excited for the Regenerative Rising audience to hear from you. First of all, because we get to drink wine, socially distanced, of course.
Absolutely.
So cheers.
Let's start out the right way.
And also because I really believe passionately that the regenerative movement in viticulture and winemaking actually has a lot to share with the regenerative movement in food and agriculture. So to get started today, I'd really like to orient our listeners. We're sitting here on this beautiful estate. It's the vitality of it. You can feel the minute you get out of your car. It's just incredible. But when you first purchased this estate, what was about 8 years ago? 13 years ago, it wasn't like this. And I would like you to kind of share a little bit about the history of the estate, what shape it was in when you bought it, and then what you were really focused on as you developed it over the last 13 years.
Okay, great. Well, you know, you mentioned my great-grandfather, and when he came over here in 1881, he actually started the business about 5 miles from here. So he was a native of Italy. He came over when he was 19 years old, went straight to San Francisco, and he started working with his uncle as a pharmacist. So he had a science background. And so he came to this place. So he introduced this area and this region to me and was a significant player in the development of the California wine business over the years. That's a long story in itself. But I've been always attracted to this area, and particularly to Dry Creek. This is a very unique valley in the sense that it's really got very defined geographic parameters to it. There's a small hill range, mountain range here, and another there, and another quite large one up at the head of the valley. And then it drops down, and the mouth of the valley goes down into Healdsburg. So it was when the property came available for sale, I was at, it, in a period of time when I was looking to actually create something new, and I really wanted to create a new brand. And I really was looking to create something that was a legacy in its orientation for my family as well, as it turns out, my partner's family. So my son Heath and I partnered up with a fellow named Phil Hurst, hence Truett Hurst. The Truett part comes from a ranch that my great-grandfather had in 1881. And we knew that, or I knew for sure, that we wanted to use regenerative or biodynamic practices here. So it was that framework that we used to envision what was possible here. And you can't, you know, if you got a river running through it, I mean, how could you not love this place? And we had the opportunity to develop this beautiful setting here, which was really an important piece of the attraction to customers and to consumers and to the public, because we wanted it to be a beautiful place and a place that people really would love to go and visit and stay and hang out and drink wine and enjoy each other's company. But the orientation that we had was one of looking at the farm like it was a living organism. And that language, if you will, comes from Rudolf Steiner in his book on agriculture that he wrote back in the 1920s, or that was written in the 1920s, I should say. And the idea there is that you recognize that not only is this a living organism, but it also has a personality and it has an expression in its own particular expression. But as a farmer, I had lived inside of that space of looking at my farm from the standpoint of trying to identify what it wanted to say, what it wanted to express. I'm always listening for that. And the same thing occurred for me here on this particular property and this particular location in its relationship to its surroundings, the river, of course, included. How would we build, I'll use the term build and create the farm such that it was fully expressed? Mm-hmm. I often use the term, use this metaphor. I say that building a biodynamic farm or regenerative farm and the vines on it is like raising a child. So biodynamic vines are like raising children, in the sense that with our kids, that we can do that would make a difference for our kids is we can't control them, we can't manipulate them, but we can contribute to the space in which they grow. And we can give them, raise them with good food, the opportunity to go to good schools, maybe the area, the opportunity to live in nice places, to make good choices or their choices, whether they want to play music or they want to be a football star. All of that's available to them. And our greatest hope is that they, when they grow up, they're fully expressed, that they live their life full out. And the same thing is true with a grapevine. So my daughter's now 20, and a grapevine, by the time it gets to 20, it has found its place and its space on the farm such that its roots have gone down deep. They're extracting the nutrients and the elements of that place and putting it into the fruit. And that fruit now expresses all of the wonderment of this particular place that we call Truett Hurst.
But let me ask you.
Yep.
Because it's a beautiful philosophy, but people should hear that when you bought this place, the former owner had literally sold the topsoil. I mean, there was no even dirt here.
Right.
This beautiful creek setting was a mess. Mm-hmm. The farm had been using chemicals. I know it took you 3 years to get Demeter and organic certified because the prohibited materials had been used on the farm prior to your right. purchase. I mean, it was really a mess. So how do you bring together this incredible philosophy and how you look at the land and the practical of how you actually make that vision a reality?
Mm-hmm. Well, the orientation was, how do we bring life into the farm? How do we bring life back into the farm in this particular case? Because you're right, it was a mess. It was degraded. There was a lot of loss of topsoil. But we just used those things that we knew that were nature's way to bring health and vitality back into the space. So we knew that the soil needed to be revitalized, and what we needed to do was feed the microbes, because it's the microbes, the workforce beneath the soil, that are going to break down those materials that we put on the soil, i.e. things like cover crops. So we planted legumes, if you will, purple vetch and bell beans and peas and clovers, which extract nitrogen from the air. So it was bringing nitrogen down into the soil naturally. And then we would grow this big bouquet of beautiful flowers that became an attractant for beneficial insects, bees and birds and butterflies. So now what we're doing is we're contributing to the vitality of the space around. And then eventually we would turn that into the soil that became a green manure. And now we're really feeding the microbes, and the microbes then break that down and produces what we call humus, which becomes a food source, a long-term restorative food process that the grapevine now has when it sends its roots down deep. So that, along with compost, compost is a really important element in regenerative farming practices. So we bring in pumice. Pumice are the pressed grape seeds and skins from the winemaking process. We brought those in, we brought in cow manure, and we brought in straw, and we would mix that throughout the year. That in itself builds its own internal life energy and life force inside of it, and it then breaks down to such a degree that when we put that back into the soil and incorporate it into the soil, it's expanding the capacity of the microbial life in the soil as well. Mm-hmm. So that's the basic lens. But then as time goes on, you start to build the organic matter from, in this case, there wasn't any topsoil. So we had very little organic matter. So we started to build the matter from very little, eventually to 2 or 3% organic matter. That then also creates this sink for moisture. So when it rains and it hits the vineyard floor, it penetrates the soil and then gets trapped like a sponge in the humus inside of the soil itself.
So they say 1% increase in organic matter in soil increases the soil's capacity to retain water up to 20,000 gallons an acre. Is
that correct? That's exactly.
It's incredible.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we will eventually get this ground. We were a bit handicapped with the fact that there was no topsoil. So it's going to take us a little longer than the 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years. It'll probably take us 10, 15 years probably to get it to the point where we'll become dry farmed so that the roots can source the moisture that they need without irrigation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's unfortunate that we can't take a walk through the property, but this estate has chickens, goats, a lot of birds of prey, a lot of water creatures. It has many, many different plants in the insectaries. Mm-hmm. You grow vegetables, which you provide to the food pantry, quite a lot, actually.
Yes, yes.
So it has that biodiversity aspect, but it all comes together in this feeling of, I just want to come here and hang out with a glass of wine, sit by the creek. Let's talk a little bit about the creek restoration, because it's a subject that's really near and dear to my heart. When I was marketing director at Kivira Vineyards, right across the creek, we were one of the first in Dry Creek Valley to start this creek restoration work. And Dry Creek Valley is really a testament to the impacts of conventional agriculture, because in the 1800s and the 1900s, they really farmed this valley floor conventionally. They cleared off all the landscape, all the native plants. The riparian areas were pretty much decimated by erosion, when there's no shade, there's no the salmon and steelhead can't flourish in the water. Just bad agricultural practices in terms of fertilizers and pesticides did their damage to the watershed as well. And there's even stories in the late 1800s and the early 1900s where the steelhead and salmon were so plentiful in this riparian area, this is really the Dry Creek Valley that feeds into the Russian River that then feeds into the Pacific Ocean. And there's stories that farmers would show up with pitchforks to harvest the salmon out of the creeks because they were so plentiful. But because of these bad agricultural practices over all these decades, there were no salmon, there were no steelhead when we did the restoration work at Kivira. And it was actually the work that we did in the creek that led us to think, we should get our organic certification. And we hired Alan York to help us do that. People in the organic and biodynamic world sure do know Alan. And he's changed the trajectory of a lot of our lives, actually. But it was he who then started us on the path of biodynamic. So it's interesting sometimes that the path to a more regenerative perspective can really come from many different places. And in Kivira's case, it was because we really were invested in restoring this riparian area. Mm-hmm. You guys here have done tremendous amount of work now on yours, including planting native habitat, recreating the weirs that the fish can spawn in. Tell us, can you talk us just a little bit about the change in the creek and what you've seen with that?
Well, as you point out, that this is really a tributary to the Russian River. And over time, there became less and less spawning on this particular creek because the fish, in our case, coho and chinook and steelhead, have a difficult time sometimes getting up into this tributary or tributaries that are even farther up. And because there's been so much development in the area and rock mining or gravel mining, that it's lowered the level of the base of the creek in this particular case, such that it's harder for the fish to get from that water that's now 10 feet lower than it was before up to the next stream and going up to be able to spawn. What we've been fortunate is the community here is well aware of that, and the water agency is quite aware. They've created an experimental project, if you will, of how to recreate the natural habitat for the fish to want to spawn, so that it's a comfortable setting for them once they get here, that they're going to want to spawn and they're going to want to come back into this area because they'll come back for 6 or 7 years. And so what we did here is we put in this large construction project, if you will, where we drove pilings of large oak trees into the ground and then tied off large trunks of trees that kind of spear out into the water. And then we split the water we put an island in the middle, so the fast water goes to one side and the slow water goes to the other. And the fish can go to that other side and they can find refuge, if you will, underneath the logs, and then they'll do their spawning there. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a significant increase over the last, all the way back to the work that you guys were doing at Kivira. Yeah. So in the last 10 years, so it's really been fantastic to see the fish coming back in spite of, you know, sort of our abuse of the health and the vitality of the waterway.
It's amazing how fast nature can come back if you give it the chance. But the lesson, one of the lessons to me, is the cost of restoring is so great.
Mm-hmm. Staggering. Yeah.
And that we have to really keep that in mind as we move forward in any enterprise that really extracts a lot from the environment. The really true cost of that is we need to start being so much more aware of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I want to go back to talking about the microbial life of soil. Mm. So one thing that I speak about frequently is this really cool study that was done by the Association of Wine Economics about 4 years ago. And I think it's just a bunch of economists that like to drink wine, but they come up with some really great studies. Mm. And they did this research project, and you might know about this, but they asked a very simple question. They asked the question, are eco-certified wines better than conventional wines? And the way they answered that question was really quite brilliant. They just took 72,000 wines that all had been rated on 3 100-point scales. Wine enthusiast, wine spectator, and wine and spirits. And they defined eco-certified as wine that was either made with certified organic grapes or biodynamic certified wine. And they put all that data into the computer. And what they found out was that eco-certified wine scored 4.2 points higher than conventional wines. So you know, as in the wine industry, that's the difference between a 91 and a 95, or an 86 and a 90. It's a big spread. To me, I'm still talking about that study 4 years later because it was the first quantifiable study that connected the agricultural method to the product quality. Working in the natural food space, I like to talk about wine because I think wine has a way of telling that story that we haven't quite talked about yet in food. And it's around that concept of terroir. So I really wanted to ask you to kind of speak to that for our listeners today.
Sure. Well, let me see. It sounds like I probably should address this aspect of the fact that can you actually make better wine by leaving chemicals out and bringing health and vitality into the soil? So you would naturally say, yeah, but of course, if you don't have chemicals in your on your property, they're doing you're farming in such a way that you're not doing damage to your property by leaving the chemicals out. So that sort of it becomes but of course. The other piece of it is I think that the vitality and the nutrition that you can bring into the soil, which ultimately will find itself into the food. When I say that, just that, it makes me think of the tomatoes that we're eating this time of year. So it makes me think of the, you know, whether if I go to a large chain of grocery chain and buy tomatoes, they really taste like cardboard. But if I get the tomatoes out of our backyard, or if I get them from the property here, or from a neighbor, they have flavor and they have vitality and they're juicy and they're ripe. And so there's definitely a difference between production agriculture, if you will, that really focuses on the soil and the health of the soil, because the farmer, the backyard farmer, has to do it right. They know that. I was sold a number of years ago. Actually, this creek makes me think of a story, and I'm going to tell a story. Is I can remember as a young winemaker, this is my aha story, if sort of discovering why organics would make a difference. I remember being out in a vineyard. This would be like 30 plus years ago. About this time year, it was in September, tasting the fruit of Sauvignon Blanc. And tasting the fruit off of one vine had all of the fruit and melon and fig characteristics I'd expect. And I said to myself, yeah, this vineyard's probably ready to pick. And then walking 10 feet over to another vine and tasting a berry that was flat and insipid. And I thought, why would that be like that and that be like that? Each year I'd have great hopes for that wine. And each year I would end up being disappointed. The wine would end up going into our everyday table wine. But 3 years after we converted that very same vineyard to organic, those same grapes started to go into our top level Sauvignon Blanc. So I got that there was a relationship between organic farming practices, where I was bringing vitality into the soil, I was leaving the chemicals out, that made a difference. It made a difference in the quality of the wine. And I started to realize a couple things. One was that the chemicals I was using, the pesticides and the herbicides that were landing on the soil, we're killing the microbial life. Mm-hmm. And there was probably a good chance that it was floating down the creeks next to our rivers and doing damage downstream. And so that it opened up a whole new world for me, where I realized that my business isn't isolated. I'm not alone. The things that I do make a difference, whether there's good or bad, and I may not be aware of the bad. And I went on a path of exploration of what would be next in my life relative to wine growing and winemaking and agriculture. Mm-hmm. So the idea of regenerative farming came to me as a result of my work with biodynamic farming. Because in biodynamic farming, we're so close to the expression of the place. We're so close to the expression of this living organism, if you will, that the idea of actually using chemicals wouldn't even occur to us, because it shows up as damage, not health, not vitality. And so we've organized ourselves around diversity of plant life, diversity of animal life, above the soil and beneath the soil, all with the intention as bringing as healthy of a space to the plants as we possibly can, such that the plants can be fully express themselves, as I said earlier, but they'll bring flavor, they'll bring body, they'll bring life. I today use this term that regenerative farming is farming in service of life.
I love that.
Farming in service of life. So in service of our own lives, our family lives, our community lives, the animals in which we farm with, and of course the life of the plants, and those who work inside of the fields,
right,
as well. So the all of the work that I've been doing lately with the Regenerative Organic Alliance came as a result of my desire to explore what's next.
Let's talk about the Regenerative Organic Alliance. So you've been a biodynamic farmer for a very long time. You've been an organic farmer you've been an organic farmer since you were at Fetzer. Then you started on the biodynamic path with your ranch up in Mendocino.
Right.
And now you're working with the Regenerative Organic Alliance. So talk to us about that. And I think that our viewers have some familiarity with the Regenerative Organic Alliance, but certainly hearing from you as a farmer and a viticulturalist and winemaker, what more is that offering you, both on the farm, how you think about your business, and maybe what you're thinking about in terms of your relationship with your customers?
Well, so there's a lot of things involved, right? Because it's when you look at systems thinking that the reality is you can't focus on just one particular thing. I will go back and I'll say I was probably a conventional farmer wine grower for 15, 20 years, then 15, 20 years as organic, and 15, 20 years as biodynamic. And so with this last 15 or 20 years, I'm going the next step, which I call regenerative. And I call it the next step because what I've come to know and experience is that not everybody wants to buy into the organic farming, and not everybody really wants to buy into biodynamic farming. It's a little disorienting, and it doesn't really speak to them, if you will. So I'm kind of looking at it from the standpoint of, what's the farmers listening? And I believe that in the regenerative realm, in the language of regenerative farming, the use of the practices that I mentioned earlier, the building compost, building up the organic matter in the soil through cover crops, feeding the microbial life in the soil. We're now starting to understand the relationship between the gut biome and the soil biome. So the farmer's starting to hear that, understand that, and has seen some proof of that. That I think that one is that the concept of regenerative is ripe, it's ready. Mm-hmm. I think farmers are ready for it. But the other thing about regenerative farming that Regenerative Organic Alliance, if you will, and the Regenerative Organic Certification brings into the conversation is two other legs of the stool, not just the ecological aspect of the farming, but also the animal welfare. Mm-hmm. Because as you know, on this farm, we probably have 30 different head of animals. We have goats and sheep and
chickens,
yep. Of course. Yeah, how did I forget the chickens? And so the welfare and how they're treated is a really important aspect of the farming, the culture of farming, if you will. Because that's not the case everywhere. The other piece of the equation is social justice, and having been working in this industry for 45 years and having worked with the Hispanic community for those years, having created an educational program for our Hispanic employees at the Fetzer Winery, I have come to know and love and appreciate the durability of the Mexican farmer and the love that they have for their family, the love that they have for their work. And so I think it behooves us as farmers to find ways to support the quality of life. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about in service of life, we're talking about just that, the quality of life of the soil, the quality of life of the animals, the quality of life of the folks that work with us on the property. So I've been particularly smitten by that whole concept that that it can be more about just the agricultural aspect of the, and not using chemicals. It can be much more than that.
I'm going to take a quick break and remind everybody that this is Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. My name is Elizabeth Candelario. I am the guest host today, and I am speaking with Paul Dolan, who is a regenerative farmer, winemaker, sustainability veteran, and just all-around swell person. Okay, so I want to go back to Regenerative Organic Alliance and ask one more question, because I think we're all pretty familiar with the organic certification that forms the base. There definitely is an animal welfare piece that is, dare I say, beefed up in their requirements. But I'm curious to know a little bit more detail about the fair trade side of it. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. We became acutely aware of in the Regenerative Organic Alliance is because we're an international organization that fair trade was developed well in the South American countries, if you will, but it really wasn't developed very, very well in the global north, as we refer to it. And the United States is smack dab in the middle of the global north. So we don't have great programs, even though I wrote about the aspect of social fairness and social justice in my book. That was really more organized around from the business setting. Here, it is in the business setting for sure, but it's in the agricultural setting. And we see that oftentimes, and we have a history of in the United States, of not necessarily treating farmers well, mm-hmm. Farm workers well. So it was a great opportunity for us and a great challenge for us to be able to create a format that was modeled off the the international approach, if you will, of fair trade, mm-hmm. the concept of fair trade. And we felt that it was is really going to be a gift, if you will, inside of the organic and the biodynamic and now the regenerative community to be able to create a framework for it that was really covered the multitude of different aspects. So essentially what you really want to do is create a welcoming a place that's safe, that provides fair opportunities, gives people a fair wage, and the opportunity to better themselves and be rewarded for the work mm-hmm. that they contribute. And so it's been a surprise for us because we're finding it so much more welcome than we ever anticipated. Mm-hmm. And I think that we'll find that this these standards that we've created for the social justice piece can be used in other business sectors as well.
Sure. I definitely think we're all experiencing through COVID where we're seeing so clearly the faults in so many systems that social justice, social equity is intrinsic in so many, and that we can't have a regenerative agriculture if we're not taking care of the people. And so I really applaud that. And I think it's really good timing.
Yes.
Because I think people are really going to be able to be more receptive in hearing that message.
Yeah. Well, I actually found for myself that during the early part of my life, I was so focused on the ecological aspect of it because I could see it around me. I could feel it. I could sense the change and see the change in the grapes. And so I was alarmed by that. And so therefore I was sort of consumed with that, if you will. And I really didn't see as clearly the opportunity that I see now when it comes to the social justice piece of it. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the aspects that really drew my attention to, mm-hmm. to the regenerative organic certification, mm-hmm. that it had that. Right. And I was so pleased that the leadership from Patagonia and Dr. Bronner's was as passionate about that as they were all the other aspects, maybe even more so. Right. And that they truly wanted to provide leadership that in a space that was missing leadership.
Right. Oh, and I guess we weren't explicit to say that you are on the board of the Regenerative Organic Alliance now.
Right.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
How many farms are signed up so far, and is that something you're thinking about doing with your farm up in Mendocino or here in Sonoma County?
Yes. Well, we just finished the pilot program, and we've mm-hmm. just opened for applications. Mm-hmm. And so the pilot program, so it was a year of development of the concept, a year of pilot participation and exploration. We're in we have pilot programs in 9 different countries. Mm-hmm. And so we're now at the space where we feel prepared that the standards are of the quality and the level of distinction that we want to create for them. And so now we've got the certifying bodies on board. We've created the framework that's becoming quite attractive to many. And yes, I'm definitely going to be on board. It's interesting, my son, who I'm in business with, we work really very closely together. But the world of regenerative agriculture has really been my world, and the world of financial acumen has been his world. And he's a much better entrepreneur than I am from the financial side. But he's embraced the regenerative just because of my speaking about it. And he sees it as sort of the gold standard, if you will. And it's what we have to do. And so he's creating his own interpretation of what those components are. Now, we live inside of the space of great social justice, animal welfare, and the ecological, the health of the soil and the healthy soils. So it's an easy transition for me and inside of my family. And you want to, inside of someone at my age and stature, you want to create a legacy. So I see that this is a really great way to do it.
It's like you're just a living example of so many things, Paul. And one of them that really comes to mind for me is that farming is a journey. It's not a destination. Mm-hmm. And that you'll be evolving as a farmer for your entire life as a farmer. I think that's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll make a little comment on this. I'm currently reading a book, Terroir and the Winemaker, and I'm reading the chapter on Aubert de Villon, who's the owner of Romani Conti. How could I forget? It's the most famous winery in the world. And he shares so beautifully that you just described, is that we live our lives inside of the possibility of exploration and creation and looking for how do we make things better in our life and pass it on to the future and future generations. And he speaks really very, very eloquently about the components that he says are important inside of the farming, those things that the practices that you would do, but it's inside of the culture of farming, which is the culture of food. And he says that there's this element that of which you can count on that's sort of solid, if you will, is that you can use this valley as an example. This valley, you know that you're going to grow here for years to come. You know what the soil and the structure offers, but you don't know what the climate changes are coming from year to year. We just called it normal variability. Now we're in this other phase. But what you do is you build resilience. You build restorative capacity inside of the soil, and you build resilience in the nature of the diversity of the activity on the farm. Mm-hmm. And from that place, you're passing on something to the next generation that they will then take and nurture and create mm-hmm. something for the next generation.
It's really quite moving to hear you speak, Paul, and it reminds me of a question I asked Alan York many years ago. I said to him, why are all the most interesting people at different events that we would go to people that were in biodynamics? So we could say in today's language, people that are in regenerative ag. And he said to me, you know, Elizabeth, it's because they're exactly the same in their work life and their private life. There is no differentiation. They are very integrated people. And it's really, really true. The values that you have as a person are no different than the values you have as a winemaker and as a viticulturalist and as a person who has control over part of our planet. And I just get, I'm very moved by that, because I think if that was true for all of corporate America and all of corporate of the world, that our world would be a very different place than it is now. You do all these great things here at the winery. You're organic and biodynamic certified. People who come to the estate see the creek. There's a great sign that explains the restoration. Anybody who has been to the newly launched website can learn all about the great work that is done here. It's actually quite informative around the biodynamic farming, around the creek restoration work. My question for you now is, how do you feel it translates to the consumer? Do your customers really care about this work? And do you think it builds brand? Because I think that there's probably a lot of people listening in today that want to make that connection between the good work that they're doing and their ability to tell their customers about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that it makes a difference for people. There's just no question in my mind. And I say that because of the experience I've had just this last year. So as you well know, we started a program with a local hotel here, beautiful hotel. They wanted to do a program and a promotion in the winter months. And we offered, you helped us, I think, actually broker that. We offered to do tours for their customers at the hotel. And I had the opportunity to sit with, I don't know, maybe 50 different small groups, 2 to 6 people. Actually, the one was a large group. And I had the opportunity to tell the story. And when they knew that they had signed up to come to this tour, and they knew that I was an environmental guy, and they knew that we were going to hang out and talk about organic farming. And they were prepared. They were prepared. They had their stories, they had their experiences, and they had their feelings about it, and they had their sentiments about it. And it was beautiful. It was just a great experience to be able to share with them the development of this property and what the view was for the future of the property and what was important to us. And the regenerative farming was important, upfront important. So that's one thing I'd say about that. And the other one is I've been working with this young couple who are millennials, and they are passionate about the possibility of linking up young millennial wine drinkers with what I will call regenerative farming operations, regenerative wine growing operations. And they believe that their generation is passionate about it, that they gravitate to it. They want to know more. They also want to have the opportunity to explore it in social settings, of course. And of course, I mean, this is about as good a social setting as you can get. So the timing is really good, I think, for us to get the word out. And for me, as you can guess, I'm passionate about it and I love it and I want to get the word out. But what I'm much more interested in is the exploration of what does it mean to be a regenerative farmer? What does it mean to regenerate the soil? What does it mean to regenerate our business? What is a regenerative, what's the context for a regenerative business? And I believe that we're on this new frontier, if you will. And one of the aspects of that is this concept of healthy soils. We used to do soil tests. Now we do healthy soil tests. So now what we're doing is we're exploring what is the active organic matter in the soil and what is its water holding capacity. And what's the, we call it the respiration, what's the microbial activity in the soil? Mm-hmm. We never measured for those before. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't important to us. Mm-hmm. We said we wanted to know how much nitrogen was in the soil and how much calcium was in the soil, right. And just sort of on and on and on. And then we had a formula. This has nothing to do with that. What this has to, it's a brand new paradigm where we're shifting from chemical farming to biological farming. It's almost that simple. So we've developed over the last 200 years, if you will, 300 years of great chemical farming practices. But that's run its course. And now we can say in the culture of grape growing or farming that we're now at this place. I'm at this place, and future farmers and some past farmers in more recent years have discovered that that farming didn't work, and it won't work for culture, and it won't work for health of the soil, and it won't work for the nutrition of food. And that's the good news. The good news is we get there's a whole new exploration for us and a whole new opportunity.
I love the reward, because the reward is in the product itself. Yeah. And so let me just take a moment and say cheers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cheers, Paul.
Thank you.
We are drinking Treadhurst Rosé that I believe is a rosé made from Zinfandel.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about this wine?
Well, our world revolves around Zinfandel. This valley, the first grapes that came to it, came from the Italians. They brought the variety Primitivo over, which is Zinfandel. Mm-hmm. And they contributed to the culture of this area by virtue of bringing that grape variety. And it works beautifully here. There's, as we know, Napa grows great Cabernet. And it's an inland area. It's a little warmer. We're slightly cooler here. We have these breezes that come right through the gap. Just ridge tops are only maybe 2,000 feet, comes down and cools the valley at night. And Zinfandel loves that, the retention of acid. And so it brings a lot of brightness to the fruit. And its companion in this area, the Zinfandel companion, is Petit Syrah. And the two of them, it's like this amazing marriage. One brings the pepper and one brings the juicy raspberry. Mm-hmm. And you get this beautiful raspberry-like, strawberry-like flavors.
It's perfect for sipping next to a gorgeous river on a hot fall evening in Sonoma County.
Yeah.
I can say this, you can't.
Okay.
Treadhurst has a fabulous wine club. They have a lot of different varietals from which to choose. So I have to give a little plug for our listeners to check out the website and also check out the wine club, which is fantastic. So Paul, thank you so much for joining me. I always love to talk to you. And I just want to say to all of our listeners, thank you for joining us in Regenerative Rising's podcast series, Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm Elizabeth Candelario. This is Paul Dolan, and we're delighted that you joined us today. Cheers.
Thank you.
The Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change podcast series is produced by At the Epicenter, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. The podcast and video recordings are made possible by the generous support of people like you. Make a tax-deductible donation or sign up as a monthly supporter by visiting attheepicenter.com/donate. Support packages start at $1 per month. The podcast series is also sponsored by several corporate and organization sponsors. To become a podcast sponsor, visit attheepicenter.com/contact to let us know of your interest. If you found this podcast episode insightful and meaningful, please pass it on by sharing it with a friend or colleague who will also enjoy it. Thank you for tuning in, for your support, and for activating change.